to talk.
So I want to welcome you all on behalf of the Campus Ministry Program, the Big History First Year Experience Program, and the Religion and Philosophy Department. I'm Harlan Stelmach, Professor of Humanities here, and we're delighted you're all joining us for this important occasion. The Big History Program, since its inception about 3 years ago, has been a disorienting event for many of us, particularly people like myself who came from one particular discipline and then we had to teach so many different disciplines. There are many ways in which we sense that this program takes us out of our comfort zones and into realms where we hadn't thought about before. One of the areas for our students and for many of the faculty members is the area of evolution and its relationship to our own faith and religion. So tonight we're going to open that subject wide open for all of you, and thanks to Ted Peters for being with us. I'm going to introduce my colleague Scott Sinclair, who's the chair of the Religion and Philosophy Program, to introduce Ted to you all. So Scott.
I first learned about Dr. Peters when my colleague Phil Novak and Beck sent me a resume saying you should check this person out. Well, the resume was 20 pages long, and I gave up after page 10. But then subsequently, when I did make contact with Dr. Peters, he was nice enough to send me a one-page resume, which I have in front of me. So Dr. Peters got his PhD from the University of Chicago and is now Professor Emeritus from the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley. He's been very active in the Center for Theology and Natural Science. He has written an amazing number of books, an amazing number of topics: systematic theology, science and religion, genetics and society, and bioethics. But for our present purposes, I want to emphasize merely his work in the issue of religion and evolution. Okay. So he's written a number of books on this topic. Okay. So he has, for example, co-authored Evolution from Creation to New Creation, or A Scientific and Theological Commentary on Darwin's Origin of the Species. But the book he was kind enough to give to me to read was Can You Believe in God and Evolution? And I gave it to a member of the science department who was so fascinated he read it twice. So without further ado, it's a great privilege and pleasure to introduce Dr. Ted Peters.
Well, thank you, Scott and Harlan, and I want to do a sound check. Can you hear me in the back? Do I need to, I need to speak more loudly, says Harlan. Okay, I will do that. That doesn't mean I'm scolding you in the front. Big history. Now I've got to get the mechanics of this down. There's no bigger history than starting with the Big Bang. Allegedly 13.7 billion years ago, and you can see here, that's the moment of the bang. If you can imagine that the entire universe was once a little hand grenade and it exploded, and in fact it's still exploding, and you and I on planet Earth are just riding the shrapnel out to see how far it goes. The Big Bang. Some people call this cosmic evolution. Religious people don't have any problem with cosmic evolution. In fact, it looks kind of like the way the Bible would describe it. So we're pretty comfortable with cosmic evolution. Now, the problem comes with biological evolution, and according to this big history, that begins about 3.9 billion years ago here on planet Earth. So we had 10 billion years of natural history before we get to the origin of life. And then here on planet Earth, biologists think, we had 2 billion years of simple little life forms floating around in fluids before the really complicated forms of life began to develop. Well, it's biological evolution that has become a theological problem. Oh, maybe it's not a theological problem, but it's certainly a cultural problem. This comes from a conservative Christian magazine. Look what we have. Here, evolution and Satan go together. And here we have creation and Christ. And the godless evolutionists are firing explosives at the very foundation of faith. And up here, they are sponsoring divorce and racism and abortion. All of that comes from evolution. What gets me is this sort of happy Christian up here. Look, he's just firing away. No target, just shooting away. Well, is there a war going on? Yes, there is. Now, here's the question. Is it a war between science and faith? And my answer is going to be no, because everybody loves science. There isn't anybody who doesn't. So it might look like a war between science and faith, but I'll try to show you that that's not the case. It's a war, but not between science and faith. Well, I come from Berkeley, and in Berkeley we, oops. We fight our wars on the backs of the trunks of our cars. And here you can see this fish. Anybody can pronounce the name of that fish? Ichthus, that's right. You can see the Greek letters, iota, kappa, theta, upsilon, sigma. It's an acrostic for Jesus Christ, God's Son, and our Savior. Well, those who are followers of Charles Darwin, they want to fight back. So we have the Darwin fish with these little feet here. If you can imagine this fish crawling up out of the primordial soup onto land and beginning the long evolutionary process. But do you think the Christians are going to get stopped by this one? No way. The ichthus is going to... And the war goes on. Well, about a dozen years ago, I got together with my friend Marty Hewlett here to look into this matter. We frankly couldn't figure out what was going on. Marty is an evolutionary biologist. He specializes in viruses. Marty's ideal for life is to go into his laboratory, close the door, and just do experiments. And if somebody would slip a little money under the door now and then, he'd be just as happy as he could be. So why is it, he wonders, there's a battle. He's also a devout Roman Catholic, a lay Dominican. He doesn't see any problem between his faith and his science. So we started out together asking who's fighting with whom about what? What is all this about? And what I'd like to share with you in the next few minutes is, well, it's sort of like a program you get when you go to the ball game, and it lists the players and what positions they play. That's what we're going to try to do here tonight, so you can figure out what's going on. We created this little graph, or spectrum, and note over here we have atheism, and over here we have an interventionist God, and the question is, how does God act in the natural world? Well, if you believe there's no God, there's no action. If you're a conservative Christian, God intervenes in the natural world through miracles, upsetting the laws of nature and then doing special things. Between those two positions, there's quite a variety. Now, my friend Marty who wants to go into his laboratory and be left alone, he just does science. If you were to add to science an ism, an ISM, materialism, now you got an ideology. And if you add atheism, wow. What we're going to do is we're going to take a look at these, and then we're going to go back and look at these religious positions. So right now, let's talk about Charles Darwin as a scientist. Was he a good scientist? Yeah, he's quite a hero if you are a natural scientist. Did his science have integrity? Well, in my judgment, yeah, it did. What did he teach? Well, I'm going to try to summarize the theory of evolution in 90 seconds. How about that? Charles Darwin said there are two factors that determine the evolutionary course of life, specifically how species are formed. And he said those two factors are variation in inheritance and natural selection. One day when my children were young, a cat found its way to our house. It was a very pregnant cat, a very ugly cat, frankly, kind of white and calico and brown and black. And the children said, "Oh, we got to take care of this cat." Well, we had no sooner made a bed for the cat in the garage, and she gave birth to 8 kittens. Now, if I remember correctly, of these 8 kittens, there were 2 brown ones. And then each of the other ones were different colors and spots, and one white, and et cetera. Now imagine if we wouldn't have brought that cat into the house. Imagine that cat out in the meadow giving birth to 8 kittens. And they're different. That's variation in inheritance. One mother, 7 different kinds of kittens. And now suppose a hawk is circling above looking for its dinner. Well, it's going to see some of those kittens sharper than others, right? Those brown ones might be invisible because they're the color of the grass, but those multicolored kittens, oh, they're going to get seen, and you can imagine the hawk coming down, killing and eating some of the kittens, but not the others. Well, the kittens that got eaten didn't grow up to have babies. But those that the hawks didn't eat do grow up, and they pass their genes on to the next generation. That's called natural selection. In this case, the hawk is the environment that selects which genes get passed on through the babies. And Charles Darwin's theory says, over a long period of time, variation in inheritance acted on by natural selection determines species. The difference between between ducks and geese, huh? Over a long period of time. Now let me emphasize something that is widely overlooked. Charles Darwin's theory had to do with species. In fact, the title of his book is not The Evolution of Life, it's The Evolution of Species. He says at least 4 times in this book of 1859, "I have no idea how life began." So evolution is not about the origin of life. Evolution is about how one species evolves from another. Are you clear on that? If you have a concept of cosmic evolution, then you have to somehow get from physical matter that's not alive to matter that is alive. But that's not part of Charles Darwin's theory at all. Okay. Now, Charles Darwin wrote in 1859, about 50 years later, the field of genetics came into existence, and now we can explain variation inheritance. Charles Darwin could look at that cat and all those kittens and observe variation inheritance, but he had no explanation. With the field of genetics, we now can explain why we get different kittens from the same mother. So, this is called the Neo-Darwinian synthesis. It's a combination of Darwin's original theory with genetics. Well, let me give you another illustration, one that's going on right now. Evolution is happening, by the way, while we're sitting right here. Did you know that? Okay, there's this psyllid, which, that's the brown one up there. That psyllid is destroying orange trees in Florida and in Southern California. I am addicted to orange juice. And I read an article recently, last week, predicting the end of orange juice because of the psyllids. Well, the psyllids have a natural enemy, and so those clever orange farmers have imported from Asia some wasp, the Tamarixia radiata. The wasp, this wasp, what it does, it will attack the psyllid, the mother wasp will, and lay its eggs in the stomach of the psyllid. And you've had your dinner? And the eggs hatch, and the larvae eat the flesh of the psyllid. And then, when the psyllid is empty of flesh, they throw the crust away, and they go on to be wasps. Cheerful story, huh? That's what Charles Darwin called survival of the fittest, or natural selection. And now make another mental note. Survival of the fittest has to do with one and only one thing. Whose babies survive to make more babies? You might think that survival of the fittest has to do with who's the strongest and who can beat up the other person. No, it doesn't. Lions are not any more fit than lambs, according to Charles Darwin. The question is, whose babies go on? And so, in the struggle between these two species right now, we don't know who's going to win. We know who the orange farmers want to have win, and it's not the psyllid. All right, what I've just tried to describe is the science of Darwinian evolution. Now let's add something, an ism. Every time you see an ISM, you've got an ideology at work. And one of the main ideology we're concerned about is sometimes called scientism. Don't confuse scientism with science. Science is just going to the laboratory and learning things. Scientism is an ideology. It's sometimes called materialism or reductionism or atheism. Let me give you an example here. This is William Provine, who is a biologist at Cornell University. And he starts by saying there are no purposive principles whatsoever in nature. Now, just pause for a minute. If you're a religious person, especially if you're a Christian person, you can't handle that. What do you mean, no purposes in nature? God created the natural world. God loves the world. What do you mean, no purposes? Well, if you're a research scientist, you don't see purpose in nature. And so what Dr. Provine is going to do now is drive a wedge between his work as a scientist and Jewish and Christian religions. There are no gods. How did he know that? At any rate, there are no gods and no designing forces that are rationally detectable. The frequently made assertion that modern-day biology and the assumptions of the Judeo-Christian tradition are fully compatible, false. Now, I met Dr. Provine. He is a belligerent atheist, and he loves to upset religious people, okay? Richard Lewontin, geneticist at Harvard University, says, we have a prior commitment. Pause for a minute. Most scientists say, I never draw a conclusion until I look at the evidence, right? This geneticist says, we have a prior commitment, a commitment to materialism, ISM. Materialism is absolute. We cannot allow a divine foot in the door. Now, is this what you would call science? No. This is a faith that is attached to science, but it is a commitment before any research is done that this man is going to believe in materialism. So, is there a problem between scientism or materialism and religious belief? Yes, it's a big one. Is it a fight between science and religion? No. It's a fight between scientism and religion, but not science. What about Charles Darwin? What did he think about this? Well, it's interesting that atheism was beginning to appear in his own era. Did he think that his science contributed to atheism? The answer is no. I see no good reason why the views given in this volume should shock the religious feelings of anyone. I had no intention to write atheistically. So from Darwin's own point of view, he did not think that his theory of evolution would be a support to atheism. Very important then to distinguish between science on the one hand and scientism on the other. Are you with me on that? Okay, good. Well, let's go back to the chart. We've just looked at Charles Darwin and my friend Marty, who are your scientists who are not ideological. And then we've taken a look at the materialists and the atheists. Now I want to jump to the other end of the spectrum. We're going to take a look at these three religious positions. I call this one scientific creationism, but you'll see in a moment we mean creationism in all its forms. Well, Marty the biologist and I, decided we needed to go and talk to the creationists, find out what they're like. The most forceful and influential group is called the Institute for Creation Research in San Diego. Everybody's really interesting is in California, right? So on a couple of occasions, we boarded a bunch of our graduate students on an airplane. We flew down to San Diego and spent some time with the Institute for Creation Research. This is Henry Morris. He's the founder. And this is Dwayne Gish. And this is one of our doctoral students here, Marty Maddox. And I took this picture just as Marty was asking Dr. Morris a question. And Dr. Morris answered, oh, that's a theological question. We don't do theology here. We're scientists. Well, we all kind of pause for a minute. He's right, of course. He has a PhD in hydrology. Dwayne Gish has a PhD in biology from the University of California at Berkeley. They are scientists. They have no theological training at all. And then they distinguish between two kinds of creationism. Biblical creationism and scientific creationism. Biblical creationism argues from the authority of the Bible that the earth is young, not old. It also argues from the authority of the Bible there is no evolution, that when the earth began, all the species were fixed. The scientific creationists have the same conclusions but different arguments. Their arguments are scientific in character. Now, of this, these two groups, I tell you, the scientific creationists are far more interesting than those who just give you Bible passages. So that's where we're going to spend a few minutes trying to understand the scientific creationists. And I want to say they are a delightful group in my judgment. So Duane Gish, I just showed you his picture. He wrote a book called Evolution, The Fossils Say No. Now note the title of this book. He's not saying evolution, the Bible says no, not at all. He's saying evolution is contradicted by the fossil record. That's a scientific argument, at least in his mind. Remember I said earlier, this looks like a battle between science and religion, but there isn't anybody who doesn't like science. So he's going to give a scientific argument against evolution. Well, not very many people read this book. Poor Duane. So he wrote another one. Evolution, the Fossils Still Say No. Now, let me give you a sample of the kind of argument that he makes. This is the Green River in Utah, and you can see how that canyon wall is stratified. The assumption that we work with is that over time, each layer was added. So, Duane Gish says, if the theory of evolution were true, then here is what you would predict. You would predict that the fossil evidence you find down here would be made of simple life forms. And as you get higher and higher, the life forms would get increasingly complex. And you would find fossils of human remains only at the very top. Why? Because this is a ladder of time. To get the logic of the argument, if you believe in Darwin's theory of evolution, you'd go from simple to complex. But, says Duane Gish, fossils of all the life forms appear at every level. Therefore, he says, the theory of evolution is wrong. Now, no, this is not an appeal to the authority of the Bible. He's saying, go out and look at the fossil record. Well, most people who affirm the theory of evolution are not persuaded by Duane Gish. And one of the things they point out is that rock is not stable. And once in a while you get a thrust fault, and all those different layers get turned on their side. This is, by the way, from the same mountainous area in Utah. And so, no wonder you find fossils of all different life forms at every level, because it's been turned sideways. Well, whether you agree with one side or the other, doesn't matter. I just want you to know this is one scientific argument against another scientific argument. Not an argument between science and religion. Well, Duane Gish also argued that the dinosaurs and human beings were contemporary. Well, the standard belief amongst evolutionary biologists is that the dinosaurs died out 65 million years ago, and our first ancestors of human beings didn't appear till 6 million years ago. And so there's a 59 million year gap in which you have neither dinosaurs nor humans. But, say the creationists, oh no, they lived together at the same time. Well, how do you know that? Because we have footprints of both dinosaurs and human beings in the Paluxy River in Texas. And I thought, oh, I gotta see this. So I went down to Texas and got to the Paluxy River, and the good news is there was almost no water in it, so I could walk out into the middle and into the limestone bottom of the river. I found that dinosaur footprint. And here's another one from a brontosaur. There's a little sign there that the Park Service had put, this footprint is 113 million years old. Well, the typical young Earth creationist is going to say, baloney. So then I looked around to see if there could be any human footprints near the dinosaur footprints. Well, what does that look like to you? Well, it's kind of like a footprint, and that's only 6 feet away from a dinosaur footprint. Could it be that dinosaurs and human beings walked on the same sandy soil at approximately the same period of time? Well, the creationists say yes, they did. They have a little creationist museum not far from this part of the Paluxy River, and they claim they have 65 human footprints mixed in with the dinosaur footprints. Well, just think about that for a minute. First of all, this is not an appeal to the Bible to say, no dinosaurs. Now, this is an attempt to look at the evidence. Secondly, the creationists say this utterly destroys the theory of evolution. I want to say, I don't think it affects the theory of evolution at all. It only says that there was an overlap between dinosaurs and humans. So I try to imagine, and as you probably know, most dinosaur bones in North America are found in Montana and Utah and places like that. So you can imagine an ice age coming down from the north and the dinosaurs fleeing to Texas because it's warm down there. Is it possible we still have dinosaurs in Texas today? Another argument that the scientific creationists give against the theory of evolution is missing links, or more technically, transitional forms. If you want to argue, as an evolutionary biologist, that first we had amphibians and reptiles in the water, then they crawled up onto land and they evolved into birds. If you want to make that argument, the creationists say, then you got to show us the transitional forms, the missing links between the crocodiles and the eagles. And there are none. Well, I read magazines such as Science and Nature, and I tell you, at least one issue a month has the discovery of another transitional form. And a lot of them, especially in China. So they are filling in the gaps of the evolutionary process. One of the things about creationists that I love is they love dinosaurs. Dinosaurs are not mentioned in the Bible. But every little kid, 5 years old, loves dinosaurs. And so creationists love dinosaurs. And they make dinosaurs contemporary with people. Here's Noah's Ark. Look what's on the ark. My goodness, it's full of dinosaurs. This is the children's material. And here's my favorite, Noah boarding the animals two by two. And the dinosaurs are so happy to be going for a boat ride. So the ark has to be a whole lot bigger than you might have thought it was earlier. So there I am standing in front of a model of the Ark at the Institute. Now watch the vocabulary here. There are many, many kinds of creationism. The one we're talking about is young Earth creationism, scientific creationism. And let me now just summarize the beliefs of the young Earth creationists. Number one, God created the world out of nothing. Well, frankly, there's nothing unique about that. Almost every Christian tradition holds that. So also do religious Jews and Muslims. So that's a good belief. It's just that it's not peculiar to creationism. Secondly, and this is peculiar, the Earth is only 10,000 years old. No evolutionary theorist can accept that. Like I say, the regnant view right now is that the Earth is 4.5 billion years old and life began at 3.9. At the origin of Earth, all the species were fixed. There is no evolution from one species to another. And they distinguish between microevolution, which is evolution within a species. Yes, that happens. If you're a biology student, you can watch it under the microscope. You can't deny evolution because you can see it in the laboratory. Macroevolution, that is to say, one species going extinct and then having another species different from it replacing it, that is what is denied, macroevolution. Separate ancestry for humans and apes. Are you a monkey's uncle, or do you have a monkey's uncle? Human beings are a separate and distinct species. We are not related to the apes. Finally, flood geology explains the fossils. I don't want to go into that. That's another long subtopic. They believe in devolution. If you're a creationist, you want to say the world was created beautiful and in harmony. And what has happened since the Garden of Eden is that we are devolving. We are getting more corrupt. Life is getting shorter. We're dying sooner. Okay? Now, are creationists fundamentalists? Let's take a vote. Everyone who says a creationist is a fundamentalist, raise your hand. Oh, we do. I'm not going to ask for the opposite. It is assumed by most people who are scientists who don't like creationists. It is assumed by most journalists who write articles about this topic that creationism and fundamentalism are the same thing. So let's pause. What is fundamentalism? Well, Christian fundamentalism in the United States was founded, anybody know what year? 1910. Was it founded by the Catholics? No, it wasn't founded by, it was founded by the Presbyterians. They had a national convention of Presbyterians, and here's the question they asked. What are the fundamental beliefs that distinguishes a Christian from a non-Christian? And let's keep the list as short as we can keep it, okay? And they came up with five. Anybody know these five? Oh, we don't have any card-carrying fundamentalists. Huh. All right, number one. The Bible is inerrant. Not the Bible that you have on your bookshelf. No. The Bible in its original autographs, when Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John wrote it, that one is inerrant. The one that you have is a corrupted translation. Number two, Jesus Christ is the Son of God, and special mention of his being born of a virgin. Number three, substitutionary atonement. Jesus died for the forgiveness of my sins. Number four, physical resurrection of Jesus on Easter, and number five, Jesus worked miracles. Okay, those are the five fundamentals. And if you believe these five, you're a Christian, and if you can't believe one of them, you're out. Well, like every convention, you have arguments and you have some losers. These are the winners. You want to know what almost made it but got voted out? Natural depravity, for those of you who are Reformed, that is to say Presbyterian, you lost on that one. Justification by faith, all the Lutherans in the house can weep. That wasn't voted in. Millennialism, literal heaven and hell, they didn't make it either. All right, now let's look at this list. Is there anything in there about science? Nothing. Is there a rejection of science? No. Is there a mention of evolution and a rejection of evolution? No. Not at all. It wasn't even a topic. In fact, God's creation of the world's not even a topic. This is all about redemption. From 1910 to 1917, a number of pamphlets like magazines were published to explain the five fundamentals, and two of the editors believed in Darwin's evolution. In fact, they were evolutionary theists. The point is that the first fundamentalists did not see a problem between their understanding of the faith and Darwinian evolution. That conflict came later in the 1920s. At any rate, if it is possible, this is my point, it is possible for you to be a fundamentalist Christian and affirm Darwin's theory of evolution. I'm not recommending it, I'm just saying you can do that without conflict. Let's go to Turkey for a minute. Interesting situation there. This is Harun Yahya, who is a Muslim, and probably we would call him a fundamentalist Muslim. And he argues against evolution using the same arguments that the Christians do against evolution. Why does he do that? Well, in the 1920s, when current Turkey was established, it was established as a secular state, and right in the constitution of Turkey is affirmation of Charles Darwin's theory of evolution. This will be taught in our schools. And so if you're a Muslim in Turkey, you see this as an assault against your faith. And so Harun Yahya is leading a crusade, so to speak, on behalf of the Islamic interpretation of creation against the Darwinian interpretation, and he's borrowing the arguments of the American creationists to do it. Interesting world within which we live. Now, before we leave creationism, there's another important argument against evolution that they raise that's not scientific, it's moral. People who believe in evolution, say the creationists, are immoral. What? Well, here's a piece of propaganda. Look, we've got creation and all those good things, we've got evolution and all those bad things. Frankly, I think this is trivial. I think it's beneath a public argument, actually. But it goes on. However, I do think there is a serious, extremely serious moral concern that I want to share with you. And that has to do with social Darwinism and eugenics. As I said, Charles Darwin himself didn't have much of an ideology, but his friends did. Thomas Huxley sponsored agnosticism and atheism against the Church of England. Herbert Spencer gave us social Darwinism to support capitalism around the world, especially in America. And Francis Galton, Charles Darwin's cousin, gave us the eugenics movement. And both social Darwinism and eugenics said, evolution is progressive. Why don't we speed it up? What we can do is we can get the right people to have lots of babies. And we can prevent the wrong people from having too many babies. Well, who are the right people? Well, the right people are smart and they're healthy. And we want them to have lots of babies. But there are other people who are dumb, physically handicapped, diseased, petty thieves, and in and out of prison. Let's sterilize them so they can't have any babies. In the California prison system, we sterilized 30,000 prisoners against their will, so they couldn't produce children as part of the eugenics program. Is there a way to improve the human race through social engineering? And the eugenics and social Darwinist movements caught on really big in three countries, actually four: Germany, France, England, the United States, and Australia. Sorry, I can't count very well. Well, when Adolf Hitler was in prison in the 1920s, he read Darwin, Spencer, and all of this stuff. And so when he came out, he created his doctrine of racial hygiene. We will, through the SS, we will accelerate the improvement of the human race. And so in 1937, the first gas chambers were created for the physically handicapped and the mentally retarded. Can't let those people have babies, right? People with diseases. And then it spread. Who are those people whose lives are not worth living? Well, let's add to the list the gypsies, the homosexuals, and the Jews. What? The Jews? Yeah, up until 1920, most Jewish intellectuals were in favor of social Darwinism and of eugenics. And then the Nazis turned the table and said, oh, but you don't have lives worth living because we're going to create a super race of Nordics, blonde hairs, blue eyes, etc. So this is a picture of Auschwitz that I took, where people were gassed to death and then put in these ovens and burned into ashes. So already, sensitive creationists, well, I should say fundamentalists in the 1920s, could see it coming. And that was the reason for the trial in 1925 in Tennessee. It was really not about the science of evolution. It was really about the militarism of Germany. That was the issue. And there were Americans who said, we don't want that in our schools. It's immoral. But unfortunately, in my opinion, today's creationists have lost that serious moral edge. Not all of them. As I said before, we have an issue over common descent. Do you and I share a common ancestry with the gorillas, the chimpanzees, the bonobos, and the orangutans? And most scientists say yes. This was already a big deal in the 1920s. And the creationists come out against common descent. They argue that Adam and Eve are the parents of all of us, and no matter what race we are all equal in the eyes of God. And they saw how Darwinian evolutionary theory contributed to racial inequality 100 years ago, and they want to put a stop to it. Now, you're not going to read this in the newspapers. It's just ignored. But if you get a creationist in a corner and ask them about this, you'll see how vehemently in favor of racial equality they are and how critical they are of those who have adopted Darwinian principles for eliminating certain branches of humanity. Okay, let me end my treatment of creationism. I'm going to treat the next two schools of thought much more briefly and then get to an open discussion. So we've looked at creationism over here, and let me remind you, there are two kinds of creationism: biblical creationism and scientific creationism. They both believe the same things, but they support their beliefs either by appeal to the Bible or by appeal to science. Now I want to turn to the intelligent design school. Has anybody ever heard of this in this room? Yes, okay. Now, as I said before, I think Charles Darwin is an admirable scientist. And if you're a really good scientist and you don't want to contaminate the research with ideology, you will honestly say, you could prove me wrong if you do this. And that's what Darwin did. He knew he was advancing the theory, and he knew where the weak points were, and he admitted them. His belief was that species changed slowly, gradually, by baby steps over long periods of time. So he said, if it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. So he's saying, I've got this theory. Come on, let me see if you can show the problem. Well, the Intelligent Design School said, Charles, we're going to take you up on it. And so the Intelligent Design people say that there are jumps in complexity in the history of evolution, and those jumps require an intervention by an intelligent designer. That is to say, evolution can't on its own move from simple to complex. It requires an intelligent designer. All right, here's the view in brief. Cellular mechanisms are irreducibly complex, and they love to use the example of the eye. Think about your eye. Does your eye have a purpose? It sure does. The purpose is to see. Well, which part of your eye does the seeing? The eyelash? The eyelid? The cornea? The optic nerve? Well, you have different cells in all these different parts of your eye, but no one of them sees. No, the only way that you see is because all of these different parts work together and contribute to the phenomenon of seeing. So if I were an intelligent design person, I would say, your eye is irreducibly complex. By irreducible, that means we can't take a part of your eye and have you see. No, the only way for you to see is to have all these parts working together, and evolution could never have produced the eye. Do you understand that argument? You don't have to agree or disagree. You understand the argument. You can't get an eye by tiny little steps. Boom, you have to have everything all at once. So there has to be, they cannot be resolved into pieces or stages assembled gradually over the course of time. The Darwinian explanation is demonstrably erroneous. Variation in inheritance and natural selection will not explain the eye, they said. The only alternative is intelligent design. Now note, my father was an engineer. He was engaged every day in intelligent design of new things. Now, is the eye like what an engineer does? Think about that for a minute. Okay, let me summarize the view of the Intelligent Design School of Thought. Complexity is empirically detectable. Of course, we all know what an eye is. Take a look. So, secondly, undirected mutations, that's variation in inheritance, and natural selection are inadequate to explain complex organisms. Complexity implies design. Oh, note that premise in there. My father was an intelligent designer because he was an engineer. Does nature do that? Intelligent causation best explains design. And who is the designer? Oh, we don't know.
Do we have any Dominicans in the room?
What would St. Thomas Aquinas say right there, do you think?
I bet you know.
Well, I need a Dominican. St. Thomas Aquinas would get to this line 5 and he would say, and the intelligent designer is the one we commonly call God. So it's an argument for the existence of God because God is needed to explain evolution. So this is not a rejection of evolution. It's a rejection of natural selection as an explanation for evolution. And God becomes necessary to explain how these marvelous and complex things developed over a period of time. That's the intelligent design argument. Well, the intelligent design people wanted their theory taught in the public schools. And it didn't go very well because the public school boards would frequently reject it. And so somewhere around 1999 or something, they came up with the wedge strategy. They would start telling the public that the theory of evolution, Charles Darwin's theory of evolution, is only a theory. And therefore, if it's only a theory, we can have multiple points of view in the public schools. Now, I have a friend named Ken Miller who writes a very popular biology book that's read in high schools around the country. And in Florida, this book was read, and a couple of school boards, this is Georgia, decides they're going to put a disclaimer on that, okay? So you're a high school student, you get Ken's book, and there's this disclaimer that says, this textbook contains material on evolution. I remember visiting the Lawrence Berkeley labs, and they were working on a textbook on geology. And one of the authors said, we have refrained from using the E word. I said, well, what's the E word? Evolution, of course. You'd write a book on geology without evolution? Anyway, this textbook, Beware, contains material on evolution. Evolution is a theory, not a fact. That got the evolutionary biologists so mad, they started stomping their feet and saying, evolution is a fact, not a theory. Okay, evolution is a theory, not a fact, regarding the origin of living things. Not true. Evolution's got nothing to do with the origin of living things. It's got to do only with speciation, right? This material should be approached with an open mind, studied carefully, and critically considered. In other words, here's Ken Miller's book. Just don't believe it. Well, Ken got mad, so he put his own accurate disclaimer in. This textbook contains material on science. Science is built around theories which are strongly supported by factual evidence. Try to be careful about that word theory. You don't have a theory if you're a scientist unless you've got a lot of evidence to back it up. Everything in science should be approached with an open mind. Who's going to be opposed to open-mindedness? Nobody. It should be studied carefully and critically considered. I think that of all my books too, right? I still say it's only a theory. Here's Francisco Ayala, my favorite living biologist. He's not a Dominican. I'm sorry about that. But he is a devout Roman Catholic. And this was the day in which he received the National Medal of Honor for his achievements in science. Francisco says that those complex things that we see in the natural world look designed, but there was no designer. They look designed, but there was no designer. Okay, he's speaking as a scientist when he says that. Oh my, no, humans didn't invent us at all. We evolved from plastic wires and little micro thingers. So if you're an intelligent design person, you're going to come back to Francisco and say, come on, how can you have all these complex things of nature without a designer? Okay, here's the question. This is Bill Dembski. He's a leader in the intelligent design movement. mathematician, theologian. The question is, are intelligent design people the same as the creationist? His answer is no. And he says, those creationists are Bible-thumping literalists, and that's not us. We're scientific. Was he so dumb? He never heard Ted Peters' lecture that shows how the creationists make scientific arguments? No, he's got a political motive for saying this. The creationists were kept out of the public schools. And the intelligent design people want to get into the public schools, and so they want to create a distance from themselves and the creationists. And so in the first decade of this century, the intelligent design people made a big push to get into the public schools, and there was a big battle and a big showdown in the state of Pennsylvania. Called the Dover, Pennsylvania case, and the judgment here was that intelligent design should not be taught in the public schools, and the judge's reading is kind of interesting. Judge Jones, ID, that's short for intelligent design, is not science. Now, all the intelligent design people said, oh, but we're doing science. The judge says, no, you're not. Intelligent design is not science. We find that ID fails on three different levels, any one of which is sufficient to preclude a determination that ID is science. Number one, ID violates the centuries-old ground rules of science by invoking and permitting supernatural causation. What Charles Darwin tried to do, and what scientists try to do today, is to provide natural explanations for things. Supernatural explanations, even if you, as a scientist, you believe in angels and demons and miracles, even if you believe them, you still look for natural explanations. That's what you do as a scientist. Number two, the argument of irreducible complexity, think about the eye again, central to ID employs the same flawed and illogical contrived, oh my gosh, he must be exhausted thinking about all those adjectives, dualism that doomed creation science in the 1980s. I don't know what he means by that, but he was in a fit when he wrote that. ID's negative attacks on evolution have been refuted by the scientific community, and that my friend Ken Miller, whom I mentioned to you, testified against intelligent design in this courtroom, and he made the case that we can explain how the eye evolved. There are 20 different ways in which the eye has evolved over time, and that Darwin was right and the ID people are wrong, and he showed that to the court. Okay, so it appears to me that ID is, well, it's no longer a potent force, even though I think it's kind of interesting. There are anti-intelligent design forces. The most important one is the National Science for Center Science Education in Berkeley. Eugenie Scott is kind of your warrior that leads the charge. Peter Hess, I don't know, Peter said he might come tonight. Is he here? At any rate. Peter is a devout Roman Catholic layperson, and he wants to stamp out bad science in the name of Christian truth and, of course, good science. I have a theological problem with intelligent design. If God designed the eye, then why are we still have to wear glasses? Okay, finally, just a few words about theistic evolution in the middle here. And I think there are two ways to go about this one, the minimalist and the maximalist. The minimalist says, I want to put together the best science with my Christian faith. And a good example of that is Francis Collins, who's the director of the U.S. National Institutes of Health in Washington. He's a devout evangelical Christian. And note how he puts them together. God pre-planned the process. Mutation, that's your variation in inheritance, and natural selection, knowing it would lead to the human race, okay? So he's put together Darwin's theory of evolution with a Christian understanding of creation. Jesus Christ is an invasion of the natural world by God. So he's an interventionist. That is to say, God enters the world in a miraculous way. He's a theistic evolutionist. A maximalist would be Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, Jesuit priest, paleontologist, certainly of all. Has everybody heard of de Chardin? Yeah, okay. And Teilhard was the co-discoverer of the Peking Man in 1929, I think. And he sees the whole of evolution as being guided by the Christ principle, Christification principle. So that evolutionary processes are doing God's will. That's just a diagram of his view. This is a painting I have in my office in Berkeley, painted by a nun who wanted to put Teilhard's theology on canvas, and you can see the cross embedded there in cosmic evolution. Here is a very interesting point of view. This is a book I co-edited with two Muslim friends from Pakistan, Muzaffar Iqbal and Syed Nominal Haq. And just recently, this past week, got translated into Farsi in Iran. Anyway, I want to tell you about Muzaffar. Muzaffar is an evolutionary biologist, PhD in biology, does research, teaches biology. And one day he said, "I don't believe in evolution." "What? You're a biologist. You're a professor of biology. What do you mean?" He says, "Well, what I really mean is I don't believe in natural selection." "Well, Muzaffar, how can you reject natural selection and still teach biology?" "Well," he says, "I believe that God, Allah, is almighty. I believe that God creates everything that there is. And each moment, the world drops out of existence and God recreates it slightly differently than it was a moment ago. And you and I, it happens so fast, you and I don't perceive it. But every change that we observe is the result of God's altering the world." This is a doctrine called occasionalism, and you'll see that a lot, especially in medieval Muslim thought. And I thought, this is a very interesting form of theistic evolution in which God and not natural selection become explanatory. So one of the points I'm making here is that the theistic evolution school is sort of like a wastebasket collection of a variety of points of view. Whereas your materialists and your intelligent design and creationist people, they're all kind of tightly organized. Well, let me just summarize at the end how Marty and I put this together. And the key issue is that we have to grant that the scientist looking at the natural world does not see purpose. And at the same time, it's hard for a person of faith not to believe that the natural world has purpose. Of course it does. So what we're trying to say is, there may not be any purpose in nature, but there certainly is a purpose for nature. And it is God who has that purpose for nature. At any rate, that's the end of my presentation, and I want to hear what you think.